Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the second inauguration of President Obama that coincided with Martin Luther King Day and get an appraisal of the 44th president from James Kloppenberg, Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. He's the author of Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. And we will discuss the apparent comfort most Americans have with their first black president. Then we'll look into the president's second inaugural speech with a former chief speechwriter for the United States representative to the United Nations and author of Live from the Campaign Trail, the greatest presidential campaign speeches of the 20th century and how they shaped modern America. Michael Cohen joins us to discuss today's speech and how much it spelled out Obama's vision to address the challenges ahead as he enters his second term with a gridlocked Congress and a divided country. Then finally, we will look into the roiling region of North Africa, where the residue of terrorism from Algeria and arms from Libya are turning the Sahel into a new front in the war on terror. The former United States Ambassador to Mali, Vicky Huddleston, joins us. She had a recent article at the New York Times, Why We Must Help Mali. And we will discuss how neglect towards the region led to a belated effort to address a deteriorating situation that could have been more easily solved earlier. Joining us now is James Kloppenberg, the Charles Warren Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. His books include Uncertain Victory, Social Democracy and Progressivism in European and American Thought, 1870 to 1920, The Virtues of Liberalism, A Companion to American Thought, and his latest book is Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Kloppenberg.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Today's inauguration of the president and his much-anticipated speech, it seems in many ways to be a ringing defense of liberalism. It also invoked social responsibility and obligations of citizenship. What was your sense? My basic sense, James Kloppenberg, was watching the president, well, this is a man that's very comfortable in his skin. He's very comfortable in the presidency. And I also feel that most Americans are very comfortable with him as their first black president.
I think that's true. I think his reelection does, in some ways, stand as almost as great an achievement as his election in the first place, because the nation was in much worse shape in 2008, and a lot of people were simply voting against George W. Bush. This time, people had to take a good, solid look at Barack Obama and compare him with the alternative and returned him to office, even though the economy is still struggling and even though we still face a number of problems. So I think it is true that this is a kind of consolidation of the first term, and he still faces a very divided Congress and, to be fair, a divided nation. But I think you're quite right that there is overall much greater comfort with him than there was the first time around.
And how much do you think the president is in the sense that his agenda and the Democratic Party agenda, I guess, is really in the mainstream? And I think, obviously, a lot of it has to do with how extreme elements of the Republican Party has become. But you get the feeling that he is sort of turning a lot of Reaganism on its head by invoking American exceptionalism, not in a sort of jingoistic, militaristic sense, but in the sense that we can live up to our ideals and improve this country.
I think that's very well put. He began the speech by invoking both Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln. That phrase about blood drawn by the lash and by the sword is from Lincoln's second inaugural. And I think it is true that he's trying very hard to locate his version of a Democratic Party ideology in a long American tradition of collective action and togetherness, and to distinguish that way of thinking about American government from the Republican Party's emphasis on individualism and initiative. And I think he was much more direct in this inaugural than he was the first time around about the difference between between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. You'll remember that he was positioning himself as the first post-partisan president in that first inaugural, and he really was, I think, hoping for more cooperation from the Republicans than he got. This time he was pretty direct and said forthrightly that his administration was going to defend Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, and that those programs do not make us a nation of takers, to use the term that the Republicans favored from the summer on, but instead they free us to take the risks that make our nation great. And that, I think, is a very long-standing commitment of the Democratic Party, and he does well to reaffirm it, I think.
And James Kloppenberg, of course, the combination of diversity and opportunity is what he's arguing is what the American dream's about.
Exactly. One could almost have put E Pluribus Unum as the title both of the address and of the poem that Richard Blanco presented during the inauguration. I think it is the case that from Obama's point of view, the diversity that the Republican Party is so uneasy about is the greatest strength of the United States, both domestically and when we look overseas. The fact that we are a nation of nations should make it possible for us to see the value in diversity. And when he talked about the problems that the United States faces in the international domain, he was not calling for war, but instead for peace and for the resolution of difficulties. And again, that's a long-standing theme of his, but he put it very strongly and I think well today.
Again, I'm speaking with James Kloppenberg, the Charles Warren Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University and author of Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. So as I now describe it in the Beltway as the optics, terrible word, but I'm being corrupted by the Beltway here. I thought the optics were quite stunning. I mean, first of all, he's an extremely attractive man and with a very attractive family. And then you had that the Kelly Clarkson singing America the Beautiful. And then you had that Cuban-American poet, beautiful reading of a poem. Mm-hmm. And then the top it all off, the finale was Beyonce, who's, of course, is gorgeous and knocked it out of the ballpark with a rendition of the national anthem. So, what was your reaction to the visuals?
Well, I think it couldn't have been orchestrated better. I mean, right down to the details of the attire of the first family and of Vice President Biden and his wife and daughter who were there. I think, as you said when you began, the entire event demonstrated the degree to which both the first family has become comfortable in that role and the degree to which America, most of America, has fallen in love with not only Barack Obama, but especially with Michelle Obama and with the two girls. So there was, I think, a very, very self-conscious attempt on their part to present themselves as an all-American family, and they pulled it off beautifully. I think you're quite right. Kelly Clarkson was doing a little bit of the sort of styling of a song that we have associated with the black musical tradition, and she actually did as much of it, if not more, than Beyonce did. I thought Beyonce showed wonderful restraint, given the pyrotechnics she's capable of, and I think, again, was very deliberately mainstreaming African Americans into the American tradition in a way that would be palatable, I hope, not only to African Americans, but to that very large majority of whites, some of whom remain quite uneasy with the fact that African Americans are now in the White House. So I think it was put together with that in mind, and from my perspective, at least, it was very successful.
So, as the president faces a divided nation and a somewhat dysfunctional Congress, at least a gridlock Congress, what do you think his legislative strategy is going to be here? Because I think we may have a kind of indicator of it in this so-called fiscal cliff deal, that if he can get bills started in the Senate and then sent to the House for an up or down vote, which is not in itself an easy thing, there's a chance that he's with the Democrats and a few wavering Republicans that he can actually have some legislative accomplishments.
I think you're right that that will be the strategy. I think it's dependent in large part on the extent to which Speaker Boehner can keep his increasingly uneasy troops together on the Republican side of the aisle, because it does seem as though at least some Republicans realize that if they simply demonstrate the same intransigence they did in the second 2 years of the first term, that they are going to be marginalized and that they may well lose big in the next by-election in 2014. So I think he will attempt to deepen that rift in the Republican Party, but we can't tell yet whether he's going to have any success doing that or not. I think the other gambit that he will try, and he made clear already on the question of gun control, is the use of the executive power, which he did less of in the first term than some people thought he should. And I think there are certain things that he can do that harken back to the first president of the 20th century when he gave that speech that you and I talked about a while ago in Osawatomie, Kansas, which some people saw as the opening of the 2012 campaign just a little over a year ago. He was deliberately invoking Theodore Roosevelt, I think, because he wanted to suggest that there are things that a president can do, as Teddy Roosevelt did, outside the obstreperous Congress that opposed much of what Roosevelt wanted to do and much of what Obama has wanted to do. So I think that combination of working with the Senate, trying to put pressure on the House, and using executive authority when he has to will be the way he tries to go forward.
And James Kloppenberg, you mentioned his remark about we're not a nation of takers, which was seemed like a dig at Paul Ryan, who was fairly visible nearby. But he also said we cannot mistake absolutism for principle or substitute spectacle for politics or treat name-calling for reasoned debate. And that's pretty clear that he's talking about, I guess, the Tea Party, and he's also talking about the deterioration of discourse here in the country. He's got most people on his side, hasn't he? I mean, the approval of Congress is down to about 8%, my understanding is.
I think that's right, and I think he was very much assisted this morning by Colin Powell, who said much the same thing, that the Republican Party needs to return to the more moderate position it took during the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower and George H.W. Bush, and to call out those people who call themselves Republicans who really have become a radical right, rather than pretending that those people speak for the majority of Republicans and the majority of Americans. All the polls indicate that that's far from the truth, that the far right of the Republican Party speaks for no more than 20% of the American people. And I think as the polls have made that clear and as the re-election of the president affirmed, there is a large and growing majority behind programs not only like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, but many of the programs that the Democratic Party has been pushing in the last 10 years. And the Republican Party had been pretending, I think, that everyone was on board with the Reagan Revolution and that that was a permanent transformation of American politics. But what the election and re-election of Bill Clinton and now the election and re-election of Barack Obama have indicated is that there is a very strong majority behind Democratic Party policies. And the question is going to be whether Barack Obama can consolidate that majority during the course of his second term.
But of course, it may well be that the Tea Party and the far right of the Republican Party's bark is worse than their bite. But when you consider how effective Karl Rove has been at organizing these people, getting a Republican majority in 2010, gerrymandering so thoroughly that in the last election, the Democrats in the House got substantially more votes than the Republicans, even though they've got the majority. And then you've got the fact that Rove is he may have made a fool of himself on election night, but he still re-signed his contract with Fox, so that machine is still in place. And so many of these people that were elected are more concerned about somebody even further to the right of them running against them in a primary than they are about dealing with America's problems.
Yeah, the gerrymandering of congressional seats in the last 10 or 15 years is a really serious problem for American democracy, because it means that more and more seats are safe Democratic seats or safe Republican seats, and that the only challenges are going to come from the left for the Democrats and from the right for the Republicans, which gives people incentive to move away from the center and toward the more extreme versions of their party's ideologies. And if we're going to get any movement across the aisle in Congress, that's a dynamic that somebody is going to have to address, and it's not at all clear how it can be addressed, especially since there's so much money to be made in the media by people who want to take the most extreme position they can take. And Karl Rove signing again with Fox News was a perfect illustration of that. There was no cost to his, from the point of view of many of us, absolutely irresponsible behavior on election night, the sort of thing you would not expect to see on a national network. So I think there is a lot of momentum that is pulling people both toward the far right and, I'd like to say, toward the left as well. And what might be happening is that the center, which is where the action has always been in American politics, is becoming more and more volatile and includes people who on particular issues are likelier to swing one direction or the other instead of staying consistently behind one party or the other. So that may mean that we'll see a continuation of the pattern of recent years of seeing pretty wide swings from one election to the next every 2 years. And so if Obama can consolidate his victory and can continue to make a persuasive case that the Republican Party is preventing the solution of the problems the nation faces, he might perhaps be able to cut into that Republican Party majority in the Congress. I'm sure that's the goal in the next 2 years, because if he goes into the last 2 years of his presidency without a majority in Congress, those last 2 years are likely to be very unsuccessful for him.
And of course, James Kloppenberg, that's all about the turnout in 2010. I think about half of the people voted in 2008. That was, in other words, all the Republicans showed up, but half the Democrats who showed up to elect Obama in the first place didn't. And he's got to reverse that clearly in 2014 and run like a president, hasn't he?
Exactly. And that's part of the reason why he's almost overnight turned the entire reelection apparatus into an electronic fundraising machine for the Democratic Party. And it's not specifically connected to the Democratic Party in most of what he's sending out to those of us who are on these email distribution lists, but it's very clear that they want to keep all of the people who were mobilized for the presidential election engaged with politics in the way that the Democratic Party used to do at the grassroots level when there were local offices that stayed in business. Now that those local offices hardly exist anymore, the best way to stay in touch with people is through the new media. And that, I think, is very much what he's going to try to do. The turnout in the presidential election in 2012 was a big surprise, I think, to a lot of people who were on the campaign trail and to many of the pundits who were predicting that because they perceived less enthusiasm on the part of the electorate than they had seen before, that there would be a lower turnout and that would be to the benefit of the Republican Party. But the voters turned out in numbers that were a surprise to people, and that's what put Barack Obama back in office. One of the things that we have to keep in mind about today is that even though there were far fewer people than turned out for the inauguration in 2008, it's still, I think, the estimates show, the second largest turnout for any inauguration in United States history. And so it depends on whether you're looking at the glass half empty or glass half full. It's not 2008, but neither is it any of the inaugurations before. And the reason for that is that there's still a great deal of enthusiasm for this man and for what he represents and for the programs that he would like to see put in place.
Well, just in closing, James Kloppenberg, not only is this the anniversary of Martin Luther King Day, as well as the inauguration, it's also the third anniversary of the Citizens United decision. And There is, not that I'm suggesting that Karl Rove was involved in that decision, but with these organizations like the American Legislative Exchange Council that he's organized or been a part of, along with the strategy that we talked about earlier that brought about the Republican victory in 2010, the impression is that they have strategy, and I'm not sure where the Democratic strategy is, and it's got to be more than an email list, surely.
Well, I think it does include a much more aggressive style on the part of the president, and I think we saw a little bit of that today. He's still arguing that there needs to be a partnership to solve problems, but I think he's not going to back down in the way that some of his most vociferous followers thought he did again and again during the first term. I think there is a much more aggressive style that we're beginning to see already and that we're going to see in the next 4 years. Whether that's enough to rally the troops, to keep them involved, I'm not quite sure. But one of the lessons of 2012, which was a big surprise to me and to many other people who thought that the Citizens United decision was going to be a catastrophe for the Democratic Party and for the left more generally, turned out that the Obama machine was able to raise an enormous amount of money, not from as big donors as the Republicans did, and Wall Street went for the Republicans this time instead of splitting and many people going for Obama as they did in 2008. But even without the big money, he was able to raise an enormous amount for his reelection campaign. So I'm with many people who would like to see really substantial campaign finance reform. But if that doesn't happen, I think that the Democratic Party simply has to continue doing what they did in this last election, and that is to beat the Republicans at their own game and outraise them and make use of the media that they do have an advantage with, and the new media, but also continue to use the more traditional print and television media effectively, so that this very sharp division between a form of individualism that Paul Ryan represents in his continuing invocations of Ayn Rand and the much more, traditional American focus on togetherness and what we can do in terms of the common purpose doesn't fade out of focus in the next 2 years before the next by-election.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, James Kloppenberg.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with James Kloppenberg, who's the Charles Warren Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. His books include Uncertain Victory, Social Democracy and Progressivism in European and American Thought, 1870 to 1920, and The Virtues of Liberalism, A Companion to American Thought. And his latest book is Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking further about the president's speech on his second inauguration. That's why I know you're my